That is, it's frightful.
Why? What harm does it do you?
Oh, you don't understand. Now that I come to think of it, you couldn't. I didn't tell you that this world has a different time from ours.
How do you mean? The time you spend here doesn't take up any of our time, do you see? I mean, however long we spend here, we shall still get back to Experiment House at the moment we left it.
Well, that wouldn't be much fun. Oh, dry up, don't keep interrupting. And when you're back in England, in our world, you can't tell how time is going here. It might be any number of years in Narnia while we're having 1 year at home. The Pevensies explained it all to me, but like a fool, I forgot about it. Now, apparently, it's been about 70 years, Narnian years, since I was here last. You see now? And I come back and find Caspian an old, old man.
Then the king was an old friend of yours, said Jill. A horrid thought had struck her.
I should jolly well think he was, said Scrub miserably. About as good a friend as a chap could have. And last time he was only a few years older than me. And to see that old man with a white beard, and to remember Caspian as he was the morning we captured the Lone Islands, or in the fight with the sea serpent, oh, it's frightful. It's worse than coming back and finding him dead.
Oh, shut up, said Jill impatiently. It's far worse than you think. We've muffed the first sign.
Of course, Scrub did not understand this. Then Jill told him about her conversation with Aslan, and the four signs, and the task of finding the lost prince which had been laid upon them.
So you see, she wound up, you did see an old friend, just as Aslan said, and you ought to have gone and spoken to him at once, and now you haven't. And everything is going wrong from the very beginning.
But how was I to know? Said Scrub.
If you'd only listened to me when I tried to tell you, we'd be all right, said Jill.
Yes, and if you hadn't played the fool on the edge of that cliff and jolly nearly murdered me, all right, I said murder, and I'll say it again as often as I like, so keep your hair on, we'd have come together and both known what to do.
I suppose he was the very first person you saw, said Jill. You must have been here hours before me. Are you sure you didn't see anyone else first?
I was only here about a minute before you, said Scrub.
He must have blown you quicker than me, making up for lost time. The time you lost.
Don't be a perfect beast, Scrub, said Jill.
Hello, what's that?
It was the castle bell ringing for supper. And thus what looked like turning into a first-rate quarrel was happily cut short. Both had a good appetite by this time. Supper in the great hall of the castle was the most splendid thing either of them had ever seen. For though Eustace had been in that world before, he'd spent his whole visit at sea, and knew nothing of the glory and courtesy of the Narnians at home in their own land. The banners hung from the roof, and each course came in with trumpeters and kettledrums. There were soups that would make your mouth water to think of, and the lovely fishes called pavanders, and venison, and peacock and pies, and ices and jellies and fruit and nuts, and all manner of wines and fruit drinks. Even Eustace cheered up and admitted that it was something like. And when all the serious eating and drinking was over, a blind poet came forward and struck up the grand old tale of Prince Cor and Aravis and the horse Bree, which is called The Horse and His Boy, and tells of an adventure that happened in Narnia and Calormen, and the lands between in the golden age when Peter was high king in Caer Paravel. I haven't time to tell it now, though it is well worth hearing. When they were dragging themselves upstairs to bed, yawning their heads off, Jill said,
I bet we sleep well tonight.
For it had been a full day, which just shows how little anyone knows what is going to happen to them next.
Chapter 4 Parliament of Owls. It is a very funny thing that the sleepier you are, the longer you take about getting to bed, especially if you are lucky enough to have a fire in your room. Jill felt she couldn't even start undressing unless she sat down in front of the fire for a bit first, and once she had sat down, she didn't want to get up again. She had already said to herself about 5 times, I must go to bed, when she was startled by a tap on the window. She got up, pulled the curtain, and at first saw nothing but darkness.
Then she jumped and started backwards, for something very large had dashed itself against the window, giving a sharp tap on the glass as it did so. A very unpleasant idea came into her head. Suppose they have giant moths in this country. But then the thing came back, and this time she was almost sure she saw a beak, and that the beak had made the tapping noise. It's some huge bird, thought Jill. Could it be an eagle? She didn't very much want a visit, even from an eagle, but she opened the window and looked out. Instantly, with a great whirring noise, the creature alighted on the windowsill and stood there, filling up the whole window, so that Jill had to step back to make room for it. It was the owl.
"Hush, hush, too-woo, too-woo," said the owl. "Don't make a noise. Now, are you two really in earnest about what you've got to do?"
"About the lost prince, you mean," said Jill. "Yes, yes, we've got to be."
For now she remembered the lion's voice and face, which she had nearly forgotten during the feasting and storytelling in the hall.
"Good," said the owl. "Then there's no time to waste. You must get away from here at once. I'll go and wake the other human. Then I'll come back for you. You'd better change these court clothes and put on something you can travel in. I'll be back in 2 twos. Too-woo."
And without waiting for an answer, he was gone. If Jill had been more used to adventures, she might have doubted the owl's word, but this never occurred to her. And in the exciting idea of a midnight escape, she forgot her sleepiness. She changed back into sweater and shorts. There was a guide's knife on the belt of the shorts, which might come in useful, and added a few of the things that had been left in the room for her by the girl with the willowy hair. She chose a short cloak that came down to her knees and had a hood. Just the thing if it rains, she thought. A few handkerchiefs and a comb. Then she sat down and waited. She was getting sleepy again when the owl returned.
"Now we're ready," it said.
"You'd better lead the way," said Jill. "I don't know all these passages yet."
"Too-woo," said the owl. "We're not going through the castle. That would never do. You must ride on me. We shall fly."
"Oh," said Jill, and stood with her mouth open, not much liking the idea. "Shan't I be far too heavy for you?"
"Too-woo, too-woo, don't you be a fool. I've already carried the other one. Now, we'll put out that lamp first."
As soon as the lamp was out, the bit of the night which she saw through the window looked less dark, no longer black, but grey. The owl stood on the windowsill with his back to the room and raised his wings. Jill had to climb onto his short, fat body and get her knees under the wings and grip tight. The feathers felt beautifully warm and soft, but there was nothing to hold on by. I wonder how Scrub liked his ride, thought Jill. And just as she was thinking this, with a horrid plunge they had left the windowsill, and the wings were making a flurry around her ears, and the night air, rather cool and damp, was flying in her face. It was much lighter than she expected. And though the sky was overcast, one patch of watery silver showed where the moon was hiding above the clouds. The fields beneath her looked grey, and the trees black. There was a certain amount of wind, a hushing, ruffling sort of wind, which meant that rain was coming soon. The owl wheeled round so that the castle was now ahead of them. Very few of the windows showed lights. They flew right over it, northwards, crossing the river. The air grew colder, and Jill thought she could see the white reflection of the owl in the water beneath her. But soon they were on the north bank of the river, flying above wooded country. The owl snapped at something, which Jill couldn't see.
"Oh, don't, please," said Jill. "Don't jerk like that. You nearly threw me off."
"Beg your pardon," said the owl. "I was just nabbing a bat. There's nothing so sustaining in a small way as a nice plump little bat. Shall I catch you one?"
"No, thanks," said Jill with a shudder.
He was flying a little lower now, and a large black-looking object was looming up towards them. Jill had just time to see that it was a tower, a partly ruinous tower, with a lot of ivy on it, she thought, when she found herself ducking to avoid the archway of a window as the owl squeezed with her through the ivied and cobwebby opening, out of the fresh grey night, into a dark place inside the top of the tower. It was rather fusty inside, and the moment she slipped off the owl's back, she knew, as one usually does somehow, that it was quite crowded. And when voices began saying out of the darkness, from every direction, "Too-woo, too-woo," she knew it was crowded with owls. She was rather relieved when a different voice said, "Is that you, Pearl?"
"Is that you, Scrub?" said Jill.
"Now," said Glimfeather, "I think we're all here. Let us hold a parliament of owls. Too-woo, too-woo, true for you. That's the right thing to do," said several voices.
"Half a moment," said Scrub's voice. "There's something I want to say first."
"Do-do-do," said the owls, and Jill said,
"Fire ahead."
"I suppose all you chaps, owls, I mean," said Scrub, "I suppose you all know that King Caspian the Tenth, in his young days, sailed to the eastern end of the world. Well, I was with him on that journey, with him and Reepicheep the Mouse, and the Lord Drinian, and all of them. I know it sounds hard to believe, but people don't grow older in our world at the same speed as they do in yours. And what I want to say is this, that I'm the king's man, and if this Parliament of Owls is any sort of plot against the king, I'm having nothing to do with it."
"Too-woo, too-woo, we're all the king's owls too," said the owls.
"What's it all about, then?" said Scrub.
"It's only this," said Glimfeather, "that if the Lord Regent, the dwarf Trumpkin, hears you are going to look for the lost prince, he won't let you start. He'd keep you under lock and key sooner."
"Great Scott," said Scrub, "you don't mean that Trumpkin is a traitor? I used to hear a lot about him in the old days at sea. Caspian, the king, I mean, trusted him absolutely."
"Oh, no," said a voice. "Trumpkin's no traitor, but more than 30 champions, knights, centaurs, good giants and all sorts have at one time or another set out to look for the lost prince, and none of them have ever come back. And at last the king said he was not going to have all the bravest Narnians destroyed in the search for his son, and now nobody is allowed to go."
"But surely he'd let us go," said Scrub, "when he knew who I was and who had sent me."
"Sent both of us," put in Jill.
"Yes," said Glimfeather, "I think very likely he would, but the king's away, and Trumpkin will stick to the rules. He's as true as steel, but he's deaf as a post and very peppery. You could never make him see that this might be the time for making an exception to the rule."
"You might think he had taken some notice of us, because we're owls, and everyone knows how wise owls are," said someone else. "But he's so old now, he'd only say, 'You're a mere chick. I remember you when you were an egg. Don't come trying to teach me, sir. Crabs and crumpets.'"
This owl imitated Trumpkin's voice rather well, and there were sounds of owlish laughter all round. The children began to see that the Narnians all felt about Trumpkin as people feel at school about some crusty teacher whom everyone is a little afraid of, and everyone makes fun of, and nobody really dislikes.
"How long is the king going to be away?" asked Scrub.
"If only we knew," said Glimfeather. "You see, there has been a rumour lately that Aslan himself has been seen in the islands, in Terabithia, I think it was, and the king said he would make one more attempt before he died to see Aslan face to face again, and ask his advice about who is to be king after him. But we're all afraid that, if he doesn't meet Aslan in Terabithia, he'll go on east to Seven Isles, and the Lone Islands, and on, and on. He never talks about it, but we all know he has never forgotten that voyage to the world's end. I'm sure in his heart of hearts he wants to go there again."
"Then there's no good waiting for him to come back," said Jill.
"No, no good," said the owl. "Oh, what a to-do! If only you two had known and spoken to him at once. He'd have arranged everything, probably given you an army to go with you in search of the prince."
Jill kept quiet at this and hoped Scrub would be sporting enough not to tell all the owls why this hadn't happened. He was, or very nearly. That is, he only muttered under his breath, "Well, it wasn't my fault," before saying out loud, "Very well, we'll have to manage without it. But there's just one thing more I want to know. If this owl's parliament, as you call it, is all fair and above board and means no mischief,
Why does it have to be so jolly secret, meeting in a ruin at the dead of night and all that?
Tooboo, tooboo, hooted several owls. Where should we meet? When would anyone meet except at night? You see, explained Glimfeather, most of the creatures in Narnia have such unnatural habits. They do things by day, in broad, blazing sunlight, when everyone ought to be asleep. And as a result, at night, they're so blind and stupid, you can't get a word out of them. So we owls have got into the habit of meeting at sensible hours, on our own, when we want to talk about things.
I see, said Scrub. Well now, let's get on. Tell us all about the lost prince. Then an old owl, not Glimfeather, related the story. About 10 years ago, it appeared, when Rillian, the son of Caspian, was a very young knight, he rode with the queen, his mother, on a May morning in the north parts of Narnia. They had many squires and ladies with them, and all wore garlands of fresh leaves on their heads and horns at their sides. But they had no hounds with them, for they were maying, not hunting. In the warm part of the day they came to a pleasant glade where a fountain flowed freshly out of the earth, and there they dismounted, and ate and drank, and were merry. After a time the queen felt sleepy, and they spread cloaks for her on the grassy bank, and Prince Rillian, with the rest of the party, went a little way from her, that their tales and laughter might not wake her. And so presently a great serpent came out of the thick wood and stung the queen in her hand. All heard her cry out and rushed towards her, and Rillian was first at her side. He saw the worm gliding away from her, and made after it, with his sword drawn. It was great, shining, and as green as poison, so that he could see it well, but it glided away into thick bushes, and he could not come at it. So he returned to his mother, and found them all busy about her. But they were busy in vain, for at the first glance of her face, Rillian knew that no physic in the world would do her good. As long as the life was in her, she seemed to be trying hard to tell him something, but she could not speak clearly, and whatever her message was, she died without delivering it. It was then hardly 10 minutes since they had heard her cry. They carried the dead queen back to Caer Paravel, and she was bitterly mourned by Rillian and by the king, and by all Narnia. She had been a great lady, wise and gracious and happy, King Caspian's bride, whom he had brought home from the eastern end of the world, and men said that the blood of the stars flowed in her veins. The prince took his mother's death very hardly, as well he might. After that, he was always riding on the northern marches of Narnia, hunting for that venomous worm, to kill it and be avenged. No one remarked much on this, though the prince came home from these wanderings looking tired and distraught. But about a month after the queen's death, some said they could see a change in him. There was a look in his eyes as of a man who has seen visions. And though he would be out all day, his horse did not bear the signs of hard riding. His chief friend among the older courtiers was the Lord Drinian, he who had been his father's captain on that great voyage to the east parts of the earth. One evening Drinian said to the prince, "Your Highness must soon give over seeking the worm. There is no true vengeance on a witless brute as there might be on a man. You weary yourself in vain." The prince answered him, "My lord, I have almost forgotten the worm this 7 days." Drinian asked him why, if that was so, he rode so continually in the northern woods. "My lord," said the prince, "I have seen there the most beautiful thing that was ever made." "Fair prince," said Drinian, "of your courtesy, let me ride with you tomorrow, that I also may see this fair thing." "With a good will," said Rillian. And in good time on the next day they saddled their horses and rode a great gallop into the northern woods, and alighted at that same fountain where the queen got her death. Drinian thought it strange that the prince should choose that place of all places to linger in, and there they rested till it came to high noon. And at noon Drinian looked up and saw the most beautiful lady he had ever seen. And she stood at the north side of the fountain, and said no word but beckoned to the prince with her hand, as if she bade him come to her. And she was tall and great, shining, and wrapped in a thin garment as green as poison. And the prince stared at her like a man out of his wits. But suddenly the lady was gone. Drinian knew not where. And the two returned to Caer Paravel. It stuck in Drinian's mind that this shining green woman was evil. Drinian doubted very much whether he ought not to tell this adventure to the king, but he had little wish to be a blab and a talebearer, and so he held his tongue. But afterwards he wished he had spoken, for next day Prince Rillian rode out alone. That night he came not back, and from that hour no trace of him was ever found in Narnia, nor any neighbouring land, and neither his horse nor his hat nor his cloak nor anything else was ever found. Then Drinian, in the bitterness of his heart, went to Caspian and said, "Lord King, slay me speedily as a great traitor, for by my silence I have destroyed your son." And he told him the story. Then Caspian caught up a battle-axe and rushed upon the Lord Drinian to kill him. And Drinian stood still as a stock for the death-blow. But when the axe was raised, Caspian suddenly threw it away and cried out, "I have lost my queen and my son. Shall I lose my friend also?" And he fell upon the Lord Drinian's neck and embraced him, and both wept, and their friendship was not broken. Such was the story of Rillian. And when it was over, Jill said, "I bet that serpent and that woman were the same person."
"True, true. We think the same as you," hooted the owls. "But we don't think she killed the prince," said Glimfeather, "because no bones."
"We know she didn't," said Scrub. "Aslan told Poll he was still alive somewhere."
"That almost makes it worse," said the oldest owl. "It means she has some use for him, and some deep scheme against Narnia, long, long ago at the very beginning. A white witch came out of the north and bound our land in snow and ice for 100 years, and we think this may be one of the same crew."
"Very well, then," said Scrub. "Poll and I have got to find this prince. Can you help us?"
"Have you any clue, you two?" asked Glimfeather.
"Yes," said Scrub. "We know we've got to go north, and we know we've got to reach the ruins of a giant city." At this there was a greater to-wooing than ever, and noises of birds shifting their feet and ruffling their feathers, and then all the owls started speaking at once. They all explained how very sorry they were that they themselves could not go with the children on their search for the lost prince.
"You would want to travel by day, and we'd want to travel by night," they said. "It wouldn't do, wouldn't do."
One or two owls added that even here, in the ruined tower, it wasn't nearly so dark as it had been when they began, and that the Parliament had been going on quite long enough. In fact, the mere mention of a journey to the ruined city of giants seemed to have damped the spirits of those birds. But Glimfeather said,
"If they want to go that way, into Etin's Moor, we must take them to one of the marsh wiggles. They're the only people who can help them much." "True, true, do," said the owls. "Come on, then," said Glimfeather. "I'll take one. Who'll take the other? It must be done tonight." "I will, as far as the marsh wiggles," said another owl. "Are you ready?" said Glimfeather to Jill.
"I think Poll's asleep," said Scrub.
Chapter 5. Puddleglum. Jill was asleep. Ever since the Owl's Parliament began, she'd been yawning terribly, and now she'd dropped off. She was not at all pleased at being waked again, and at finding herself lying on bare boards in a dusty belfry sort of place, completely dark and almost completely full of owls. She was even less pleased when she heard that they had to set off for somewhere else, and not apparently for bed, on the owl's back.
"Oh, come on, Poll, buck up," said Scrub's voice. "After all, it is an adventure. "'I'm sick of adventures,' said Jill crossly. She did, however, consent to climb onto Glimfeather's back, and was thoroughly waked up for a while by the unexpected coldness of the air when he flew out with her into the night. The moon had disappeared, and there were no stars. Far behind her, she could see a single lighted window well above the ground, doubtless in one of the towers of Caer Paravel. It made her long to be back in that delightful bedroom, snug in bed, watching the firelight on the walls. She put her hands under her cloak and wrapped it tightly round her. It was uncanny to hear two voices in the dark air a little distance away. Scrub and his owl were talking to one another. "He doesn't sound tired," thought Jill. She did not realize that he'd been on great adventures in that world before, and that the Narnian air was bringing back to him a strength he had won when he sailed the eastern seas with King Caspian. Jill had to pinch herself to keep awake, for she knew that if she dozed on Glimfeather's back, she would probably fall off. When, at last, the two owls ended their flight, she climbed stiffly off Glimfeather and found herself on flat ground. A chilly wind was blowing, and they appeared to be in a place without trees. "Too-woo, too-woo," Glimfeather was calling. "Wake up, Puddleglum, wake up. It is on the lion's business." For a long time there was no reply. Then a long way off, a dim light appeared and began to come nearer. With it came a voice.
"Owls ahoy," it said. "What is it? Is the king dead? Has an enemy landed in Narnia? Is it a flood or dragons?"
When the light reached them, it turned out to be that of a large lantern. Jill could see very little of the person who held it. He seemed to be all legs and arms. The owls were talking to him, explaining everything, but she was too tired to listen. She tried to wake herself up a bit when she realized that they were saying goodbye to her, but she could never afterwards remember much except that sooner or later she and Scrub were stooping to enter a low doorway, and then, oh, thank heavens, were lying down on something soft and warm, and a voice was saying,
"There you are, best we can do. You'll lie cold and hard. Damp, too, I shouldn't wonder. Won't sleep a wink, most likely. Even if there isn't a thunderstorm or a flood, or the wigwam didn't fall down on the top of us all as I've known them do. Must make the best of it." But she was fast asleep before the voice had ended.
When the children woke late the next morning, they found that they were lying very dry and warm on beds of straw in a dark place. A triangular opening let in the daylight.
"Where on earth are we?" asked Jill.
"In the wigwam of a marsh wiggle," said Eustace.
"A what?"
"A marsh wiggle. Don't ask me what it is. I couldn't see it last night. I'm getting up. Let's go and look for it."
"How beastly one feels after sleeping in one's clothes," said Jill, sitting up.
"I was just thinking how nice it was not to have to dress," said Eustace.
"Or wash either, I suppose," said Jill scornfully. But Scrub had already got up, yawned, shaken himself, and crawled out of the wigwam. Jill did the same. What they found outside was quite unlike the bit of Narnia they had seen on the day before. They were on a great flat plain, which was cut into countless little islands by countless channels of water. The islands were covered with coarse grass and bordered with reeds and rushes. Sometimes there were beds of rushes about an acre in extent. Clouds of birds were constantly alighting in them and rising from them again. Ducks, snipe, bitterns, herons. Many wigwams, like that in which they had passed the night, could be seen dotted about, but all at a good distance from one another, for marsh wiggles are people who like privacy. Except for the fringe of the forest several miles to the south and west of them, there was not a tree in sight. Eastward, the flat marsh stretched to low sandhills on the horizon, and you could tell by the salt tang in the wind which blew from that direction that the sea lay over there. To the north, there were low, pale-coloured hills, in places bastioned with rock. The rest was all flat marsh.
It would have been a depressing place on a wet evening. Seen under a morning sun, with a fresh wind blowing, and the air filled with the crying of birds, there was something fine and fresh and clean about its loneliness. The children felt their spirits rise. "Where has the thingamy got to, I wonder," said Jill. "The marshwiggle," said Scrub, as if he were rather proud of knowing the word. "I expect, oh, hello, that must be him." And then they both saw him, sitting with his back to them, fishing, about 50 yards away. It'd been hard to see at first, because he was nearly the same colour as the marsh, and because he sat so still. "I suppose we'd better go and speak to him," said Jill. Scrub nodded. They both felt a little nervous. As they drew nearer, the figure turned its head and showed them a long, thin face, with rather sunken cheeks, a tightly shut mouth, a sharp nose, and no beard. He was wearing a high, pointed hat like a steeple, with an enormously wide, flat brim. The hair, if it could be called hair, which hung over his large ears, was greeny-grey, and each lock was flat rather than round, so that they were like tiny reeds. His expression was solemn, his complexion muddy, and you could see at once that he took a serious view of life.
"Good morning, guests," he said. "Though when I say good, I don't mean it won't probably turn to rain, or it might be snow or fog or thunder. You didn't get any sleep, I dare say."
"Yes, we did, though," said Jill. "We had a lovely night."
"Ah," said the marshwiggle, shaking his head, "I see you're making the best of a bad job. That's right. You've been well brought up, you have. You've learnt to put a good face on things."
"Please, we don't know your name," said Scrub.
"Puddleglum's my name, but doesn't matter if you forget it. I can always tell you again."
The children sat down on each side of him. They now saw that he had very long legs and arms, so that although his body was not much bigger than a dwarf's, he would be taller than most men when he stood up. The fingers of his hands were webbed like a frog's, and so were his bare feet, which dangled in the muddy water. He was dressed in earth-coloured clothes that hung loose about him.
"I'm trying to catch a few eels to make an eel stew for our dinner," said Puddleglum, "though you shouldn't wonder if I didn't get any, and you won't like them much if I do."
"Why not?" asked Scrub.
"Why, it's not in reason that you should like our sort of victuals, though I've no doubt you'll put a bold face on it. All the same, while I am a-catching of them, if you two could try to light the fire, there's no harm in trying. The wood's behind the wigwam. It may be wet. You could light it inside the wigwam, and then we'd get all the smoke in our eyes, or you could light it outside, and then the rain would come and put it out. Here is my tinder box. You won't know how to use it, I expect."
But Scrub had learnt that sort of thing on his last adventure. The children ran back together to the wigwam, found the wood, which was perfectly dry, and succeeded in lighting a fire with rather less than the usual difficulty. Then Scrub sat and took care of it while Jill went and had some sort of wash, not a very nice one, in the nearest channel. After that, she saw to the fire, and he had a wash. Both felt a good deal fresher, but very hungry. Presently the marshwiggle joined them. In spite of his expectation of catching no eels, he had a dozen or so, which he had already skinned and cleaned. He put a big pot on, mended the fire, and lit his pipe. Marshwiggles smoke a very strange, heavy sort of tobacco. Some people say they mix it with mud. And the children noticed the smoke from Puddleglum's pipe hardly rose in the air at all. It trickled out of the bowl, and downwards, and drifted along the ground like a mist. It was very black, and set Scrub coughing.
"Now," said Puddleglum, "those eels will take a mortal long time to cook, and either of you might faint with hunger before they're done. I knew a little girl, but I better not tell you that story. It might lower your spirits, and that's a thing I never do. So to keep your minds off your hunger, we may as well talk about our plans."
"Yes, do let's," said Jill. "Can you help us to find Prince Rillian?"
The marshwiggle sucked in his cheeks till they were hollower than you would have thought possible.
"Well, don't know that you call it a help," he said. "Don't know that anyone could exactly help. It stands to reason we're not likely to get very far on a journey to the north, not this time of year, with the winter coming on so soon and all. And an early winter, too, by the look of things. But you mustn't let that make you downhearted. Very likely what with enemies and mountains and rivers to cross and losing our way, next to nothing to eat and sore feet, we'll hardly notice the weather. And if we don't get far enough to do any good, we may get far enough not to get back in a hurry." Both children noticed that he said "we," not "you," and both exclaimed at the same moment, "Are you coming with us?" "Oh, yes, I'm coming, of course. Might as well, you see. Don't suppose we shall ever see the king back in Narnia, now that he's once set off for foreign parts. And he had a nasty cough when he left. And then there's Trumpkin. He's failing fast. And you'll find there'll have been a bad harvest after this terrible dry summer. I shouldn't wonder if some enemy attacked us, mark my words."
"And how shall we start?" said Scrub.
"Well," said the Marsh Wiggle very slowly, "all the others, whoever went looking for Prince Rillian, started from that same fountain where the Lord Drinian saw the lady. They went north, mostly, and as none of them ever came back, we can't exactly say how they got on."
"We've got to start by finding a ruined city of giants," said Jill. "Aslan said so."
"Got to start by finding it, have we?" answered Puddleglum. "Not allowed to start by looking for it, I suppose."
"Well, that's what I meant, of course," said Jill.
"And then when we found it..."
"Yes, when," said Puddleglum very dryly. "Doesn't anyone know where it is?" asked Scrub.
"I don't know about anyone," said Puddleglum. "And I won't say I haven't heard of that ruined city. You wouldn't start from the fountain, though. You'd have to go across Ettensmore. That's where the ruined city is, if it's anywhere. But I've been as far in that direction as most people, and I never got to any ruins, so I won't deceive you."
"Where's Ettensmore?" said Scrub.
"Look over there, northward," said Puddleglum, pointing with his pipe.
"You see those hills and bits of cliff? That's the beginning of Ettensmore.
But there's a river between it and us, the River Shribble. No bridges, of course."
"I suppose we can ford it, though," said Scrub.
"Well, it has been forded," admitted the Marsh Wiggle.
"Perhaps we shall meet people on Ettensmore who can tell us the way," said Jill.
"You're right about meeting people," said Puddleglum.
"But what sort of people live there?" she asked.
"It's not for me to say they aren't all right in their own way," answered Puddleglum, "if you like their way."
"Yes, but what are they?" pressed Jill. "There are so many strange creatures in this country. I mean, are they animals, or birds, or dwarfs, or what?"
The Marsh Wiggle gave a long whistle.
"Phew," he said. "Don't you know? I thought the owls had told you. They're giants."
Jill winced. She had never liked giants, even in books, and she had once met one in a nightmare. Then she saw Scrub's face, which had turned rather green, and thought to herself, "I bet he's in a worse funk than I am." That made her feel braver.
"The king told me long ago," said Scrub, "that time when I was with him at sea, that he'd jolly well beaten those giants in war and made them pay him tribute."
"That's true enough," said Puddleglum. "They're at peace with us all right. As long as we stay on our side of the Shribble, they won't do us any harm. Over on their side, on the moor, still there's always a chance. If we don't get near any of them, and if none of them forget themselves, and we're not seen, it's just possible we might get a long way."
"Look here," said Scrub, suddenly losing his temper, as people so easily do when they have been frightened. "I don't believe the whole thing can be half as bad as you're making out, any more than the beds in the wigwam were hard or the wood was wet. I don't think Aslan would ever have sent us if there was so little chance as all that."
He quite expected the Marsh Wiggle to give him an angry reply, but he only said, "Oh, that's the spirit, Scrub. That's the way to talk. Put a good face on it. But we all need to be very careful about our tempers, seeing all the hard times we shall have to go through together. Won't do to quarrel, you know.
At any rate, don't begin it too soon. I know these expeditions usually end that way, knifing one another, I shouldn't wonder, before all's done. But the longer we can keep off it...
Well, if you feel it so hopeless, interrupted Scrub, I think you'd better stay behind. Pole and I can go on alone, can't we, Pole?
Shut up and don't be an ass, Scrub, said Jill hastily, terrified lest the Marshwiggle should take him at his word.
Don't you lose heart, Pole, said Puddleglum. I'm coming, sure and certain.
I'm not going to lose an opportunity like this. It would do me good.
They all say, I mean the other Wiggles all say, that I'm too flighty. Don't take life seriously enough.
They said it once, they said it a thousand times. Puddleglum, they've said, you're altogether too full of bobbins and bounce and high spirits. You've got to learn that life isn't all fricasseed frogs and eel pie. You want something to sober you down a bit. We're only saying it for your own good, Puddleglum.
That's what they say.
Now a job like this, a journey up north just as winter's beginning, looking for a prince who probably ain't there, by way of a ruined city that no one has ever seen, will be just the thing. If that don't steady a chap, I don't know what will. And he rubbed his big frog-like hands together as if he were talking of going to a party or a pantomime. And now, he added, let's see how those eels are getting on. When the meal came, it was delicious, and the children had two large helpings each. At first, the Marshwiggle wouldn't believe that they really liked it, and when they had eaten so much that he had to believe them, he fell back on saying that it would probably disagree with them horribly. "Was food for Wiggles may be poison for humans, I shouldn't wonder," he said. After the meal, they had tea, in tins, as you've seen men having it who are working on the road, and Puddleglum had a good many sips out of a square black bottle. He offered the children some of it, but they thought it very nasty. The rest of the day was spent in preparations for an early start the next morning. Puddleglum, being far the biggest, said he would carry three blankets with a large bit of bacon rolled up inside them. Jill was to carry the remains of the eels, some biscuit, and the tinderbox. Scrub was to carry both his own cloak and Jill's when they didn't want to wear them. Scrub, who had learned some shooting when he sailed to the east under Caspian, had Puddleglum's second-best bow, and Puddleglum had his best one, though he said that what with winds and damp bowstrings and bad light and cold fingers, it was 100 to 1 against either of them hitting anything. He and Scrub both had swords. Scrub had brought the one which had been left out for him in his room at Caer Paravel, but Jill had to be content with her knife. There would have been a quarrel about this, but as soon as they started sparring, the Wiggle rubbed his hands and said, "Ah, there you are, thought as much. That's what usually happens on adventures." This made them both shut up. All three went to bed early in the wigwam. This time the children really had a rather bad night. That was because Puddleglum, after saying, "You better try for some sleep, you two, not that I suppose any of us will close an eye tonight," instantly went off into such a loud, continuous snore that when Jill at last got to sleep, she dreamed all night about road drills and waterfalls and being in express trains in tunnels. Chapter 6. The Wild Wastelands of the North. At about 9 o'clock the next morning, three lonely figures might have been seen picking their way across the Shribble by the shoals and stepping stones. It was a shallow, noisy stream, and even Jill was not wet above her knees when they reached the northern bank. About 50 yards ahead, the land rose up to the beginning of the moor, everywhere steeply, and often in cliffs.
"I suppose that's our way," said Scrub, pointing left and west to where a stream flowed down from the moor through a shallow gorge. But the Marshwiggle shook his head.
"The giants mainly live along the side of that gorge," he said. "You might say the gorge was like a street to them. We'll do better straight ahead, even though it's a bit steep."
They found a place where they could scramble up, and in about 10 minutes stood panting at the top. They cast a longing look back at the valley land of Narnia, and then turned their faces to the north. The vast, lonely moor stretched on and up as far as they could see. On their left was rockier ground,
Jill thought that must be the edge of the giant's gorge, and did not much care about looking in that direction. They set out. It was good springy ground for walking, and a day of pale winter sunlight. As they got deeper into the moor, the loneliness increased. One could hear peewits and see an occasional hawk. When they halted in the middle of the morning for a rest and a drink in a little hollow by a stream, Jill was beginning to feel that she might enjoy adventures after all, and said so.
"We hadn't had any yet," said the marsh wiggle.
Walks after the first halt, like school mornings after break or railway journeys after changing trains, never go on as they were before. When they set out again, Jill noticed that the rocky edge of the gorge had drawn nearer, and the rocks were less flat, more upright than they had been. In fact, they were like little towers of rock. And what funny shapes they were! "I do believe," thought Jill, "that all the stories about giants might have come from those funny rocks. If you were coming along here when it was half dark, you could easily think those piles of rock were giants. Look at that one now. You could almost imagine that the lump on top was a head. It'd be rather too big for the body, but it would do well enough for an ugly giant. And all that bushy stuff, I suppose it's heather and bird's nests, really, would do quite well for hair and beard. And the things sticking out on each side are quite like ears. They'd be horribly big. But then I dare say giants would have big ears like elephants, and—" Oh! Her blood froze. The thing moved. It was a real giant. There was no mistaking it. She had seen it turn its head. She had caught a glimpse of the great, stupid, puff-cheeked face. All the things were giants, not rocks. There were 40 or 50 of them, all in a row, obviously standing with their feet on the bottom of the gorge and their elbows resting on the edge of the gorge, just as men might stand leaning on a wall, lazy men, on a fine morning after breakfast. "Keep straight on," whispered Puddleglum, who had noticed them too. "Don't look at them, and whatever you do, don't run. They'd all be after us in a moment." So they kept on, pretending not to have seen the giants. It was like walking past the gate of a house where there is a fierce dog, only far worse. There were dozens and dozens of these giants. They didn't look angry or kind or interested at all. There was no sign that they had seen the travellers. Then, whiss, 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 some heavy object came hurtling through the air, and with a crash, a big boulder fell about 20 paces ahead of them, and then, thud, another fell 20 feet behind.
"Are they aiming at us?" asked Scrub.
"No," said Puddleglum. "We'd be a good deal safer if they were. They're trying to hit that cairn over there to the right. They won't hit it, you know. It's safe enough. They're such very bad shots. They play cockshies most fine mornings, but the only game they're clever enough to understand."
It was a horrible time. There seemed no end to the line of giants, and they never ceased hurling stones, some of which fell extremely close. Quite apart from the real danger, the very sight and sound of their faces and voices were enough to scare anyone. Jill tried not to look at them. After about 25 minutes, the giants apparently had a quarrel. This put an end to the cockshies, but it is not pleasant to be within a mile of quarrelling giants. They stormed and jeered at one another in long, meaningless words of about 20 syllables each. They foamed and gibbered and jumped in their rage, and each jump shook the earth like a bomb. They lammed each other on the head with great, clumsy stone hammers, but their skulls were so hard that the hammers bounced off again, and then the monster who had given the blow would drop his hammer and howl with pain because it had stung his fingers. But he was so stupid that he would do exactly the same thing a minute later. This was a good thing in the long run, for by the end of an hour, all the giants were so hurt that they sat down and began to cry. When they sat down, their heads were below the edge of the gorge, so that you saw them no more. But Jill could hear them howling and blubbering and boo-hooing like great babies, even after the place was a mile behind. That night they bivouacked on the bare moor, and Puddleglum showed the children how to make the best of their blankets by sleeping back to back. The backs keep each other warm, and you can then have both blankets on top. But it was chilly even so, and the ground was hard and lumpy. The marshwiggle told them they would feel more comfortable if only they thought how very much colder it would be later on and further north, but this didn't cheer them up at all. They travelled across Ettinsmore for many days, saving the bacon and living chiefly on the moorfowl. They were not, of course, talking birds, which Eustace and the Wiggle shot. Jill rather envied Eustace for being able to shoot. He had learnt it on his voyage with King Caspian. As there were countless streams on the moor, they were never short of water. Jill thought that when in books people live on what they shoot, it never tells you what a long, smelly, messy job it is plucking and cleaning dead birds, and how cold it makes your fingers. But the great thing was that they met hardly any giants. One giant saw them, but he only roared with laughter and stumped away about his own business. About the 10th day, they reached a place where the country changed. They came to the northern edge of the moor and looked down a long, steep slope into a different and grimmer land. At the bottom of the slope were cliffs. Beyond these, a country of high mountains, dark precipices, stony valleys, ravines so deep and narrow that one could not see far into them, and rivers that poured out of echoing gorges to plunge sullenly into black depths. Needless to say, it was Puddleglum who pointed out a sprinkling of snow on the more distant slopes. "But there'll be more on the north side of them, I shouldn't wonder," he added. It took them some time to reach the foot of the slope, and when they did, they looked down from the top of the cliffs at a river running below them from west to east. It was walled in by precipices on the far side as well as on their own, and it was green and sunless, full of rapids and waterfalls. The roar of it shook the earth, even where they stood.
"The bright side of it is," said Puddleglum, "if we break our necks getting down the cliff, then we're safe from being drowned in the river."
"What about that?" said Scrub suddenly, pointing upstream to their left. Then they all looked and saw the last thing they were expecting, a bridge. And what a bridge, too! It was a huge, single arch that spanned the gorge from clifftop to clifftop, and the crown of that arch was as high above the clifftops as the dome of St. Paul's is above the street.
"Why, it must be a giant's bridge," said Jill.
"Or a sorcerer's, more likely," said Puddleglum.
"We've got to look out for enchantments in a place like this. I think it's a trap. I think it'll turn into mist and melt away just when we're out in the middle of it."
"Oh, for goodness sake, don't be such a wet blanket," said Scrub. "Why on earth shouldn't it be a proper bridge?
Do you think any of the giants we've seen would have the sense to build a thing like that?" said Puddleglum.
"But mightn't it have been built by other giants," said Jill. "I mean, by giants who lived hundreds of years ago and were far cleverer than the modern kind. It might have been built by the same ones who built the giant city we're looking for, and that would mean we were on the right track, the old bridge leading to the old city."
"That's a real brainwave, Poll," said Scrub. "It must be that. Come on."
So they turned and went to the bridge. And when they reached it, it certainly seemed solid enough. The single stones were as big as those at Stonehenge, and must have been squared by good masons once, though now they were cracked and crumbled. The balustrade had apparently been covered with rich carvings, of which some traces remained, mouldering faces and forms of giants, minotaurs, squids, centipedes, and dreadful gods. Puddleglum didn't trust it, but he consented to cross it with the children. The climb up to the crown of the arch was long and heavy. In many places the great stones had dropped out, leaving horrible gaps, through which you looked down on the river foaming thousands of feet below.